I hope that today is just a benefit to you. It's just a fun exercise. And a benefit for us who are older, this is we'll just call this sort of the benefit of retrospect. And I see most of us have gray hair or no hair in this room. There are, however, a spattering of younger couples and a couple of younger people. So I hope there's something kind of for everybody here. But here's my thesis. It's based upon this. You know, if life is like a game of pool, got all these ball balls here, and then you line one ball up here, and you hit this one hard, it smashes all these, and all of these then take off into the four corners of the table, and the objective is to get them done. That's kind of like life. Because my theory is this, that every 10 years, we regather the balls and we start all over again. And the reason I know that is because the questions of life change every 10 years. So what I've done is I've broken a 90-year-old's life down into 10-year sections, into decades, and suggesting that certain questions were important at that particular time that may not be important in the future and may not have been important in the past, but they are important at that particular phase. So life is like this. Every time, every 10 years, we regather the balls, and then boom, we smash it, and then the process is that of regathering the balls to take on the next 10 years. So I want to take you through some of the 10-year experiences that we have. Now, what I'm doing today is something that we would probably sometimes take 2 hours over, so I'm not going to do that, you'll be pleased to know. But we used last night a picture of a Noughts and Cross sign, because you guys can't absorb more than 9 concepts, I'm told. So I'm sticking, and each concept will have a picture to make it more memorable, and then you'll get the benefit of my good artwork as well. From age 1 to 10, the question of life from a child is, do you like me? Notice I didn't say, do you love me? Because a kid is presuming that you love him or her. From the day that you are born, you are seeking approval. You are presuming love, but you are seeking to be liked. Ask a kid when he goes to school, you know, do you like your teacher, you know? And if the teacher likes the teacher doesn't love the kid. The kid is loved by the teacher. The interesting thing is that at that stage and at every phase in life, we have what we call, and you've heard the term, significant others. Everybody at every stage in life has a different significant other, somebody who you're seeking approval from. Now, when a kid is 1 to 10, he's not always seeking approval from his parents because his teacher has become his or her significant other. And what the teacher says about the kid in many times is more important than what the parents say about the kid. My teacher says this. How many times have you heard your kid come back? And you're going to hear this, guys. Oh, man, hey, daddy, my teacher said this. And you think, haven't I been saying that for a long time and nobody's been listening? But you're not the source of authority anymore. The teacher has become the significant other and has become the source of authority whereby you live according to your significant other. Every kid is out there wanting to be liked. Okay, that's your first symbol. They just want to be liked. Now, the interesting thing is that generally we listen to people we like more than people we love. That's intriguing. That's why peer pressure is so important. We will listen to, and peer pressure is relevant at every phase in life. You do know that. It's not just reserved for teenage years. Peer pressure, we will respond and we do the things and we respond to the people who like us and we like them more than the people that we love. That's why we can so often go wrong. And as parents, we have to bring into our children's lives people who we like, that we think are going to be a good role model. That's why I'm so grateful. As my kids went through their teenage years, just prior to this, we had a young man walk into our life. He was a young medical intern. And my kids liked him, and he liked them. His name was Theo. And what Theo would say to the kids was the same thing I was saying, but they were blown away by what Theo says. You know, I'm not impressive anymore. Theo did. And I'm so grateful to this young man that he showed such an interest in my kids. I think he loved them, but more so, he really liked them. And every kid wants to be liked. Every kid is saying, will you invest in me? Will you listen to me? Will you give me time? Will you make eye contact with me? Will you take interest in my life? So at the first phase 1 to 10, right back in the basics, we're saying, do you like me? From the age 10 to 20, the question changes to, who am I? Every kid is trying to find him or herself. It's an incredible time of change. You know, physically, they're beginning to change even more than probably any other phase in their lives. And when you move from 10 to 20, you know, when you trade your pimples in for your hair loss, you know, you're changing physically all the time. And the moment you got rid of one problem, another problem arises. Now we're hitting 60 horsepower and we've got a bit of a problem. I don't know if you've noticed. He used to have a six-pack. Now he's got a keg. So we're continually changing. But at that stage in life, the kid is asking, who am I? And they go to the dumbest sources to find out who they are. They will go to MTV. And they'll ask, MTV, can you help to define me? They will go to their peers who are not doing so well. And the peers will then try and define who they are. And it's at this stage in a child's life that the shaping of who they are needs to come around and be vitally, vitally important. You know, parents, we need to speak stronger into our kids' lives. Even if they don't always listen to us. I talk to parents and I talk to teenagers all day long. It's my job and I love doing it. But the parents are saying, oh, he'll grow out of this. Oh, the world is telling him to do this. The world is telling him to say, what are you saying? I'm saying nothing. I can't compete with the world. Well, I tell you what, parents, we need to compete with the world. We may not always win, you know, but there needs to be a stronger voice from parents, not telling them just who they, you know, are, but whose they are. When you're owned as a child and you know that your identity is not about so much who you are, but whose you are, tell you what, there's a great spiritual dynamic for us today. Not about who I am, it's whose I am that should make the big difference in life. And as fathers and mothers, our role for our kids need to help them to define themselves based upon whose they are. You're my child. I have a vision for you. I have a passion for you. I will sacrifice for you, and I will love you unconditionally. And that is what the security that a kid can build upon the foundation of his or her life. There's a guy by the name of Tony Campolo who makes an interesting observation. He says this. He says that in order to find out who you are, you know, every kid is out there traveling the world trying to find their identity. The identity is not waiting to be found. You do know that. I see kids coming in my office and they're all messed up. And I say, well, you know, what are you going to do? Oh, Jungle Trevor, I need to find myself. Yeah, I need to find myself. Have you ever met anybody who has found themselves? I haven't. That's because in essence, the self is not waiting to be found. The self is waiting to be created. You create a self. You don't find yourself. You don't say, a kid comes and says, gee, Uncle Trevor, on the top of Table Mountain, I found myself. I've never heard that. Because the self is not waiting to be found. It is waiting to be created. And there's only one way to create a self, and that is through commitment. Commitment creates identity. It's commitment that creates a self. And when you grow up in an environment, as parents, as grandparents, have a huge role to help challenge our kids to make not just good choices, but good commitments to certain things. Now, I had the benefit of a father who understood this concept, and I don't come from a perfect family, but it was good. And I remember my father just emphasizing, and I think he even knew that he was doing it, the importance of commitment. That on the day that I left school and I joined the army up in Zimbabwe, he said to me, he says, Trevor, he says, you've been raised in this family, you know our values, you know our standards, you know what we are. And my dad didn't often say much, but when he said stuff, we generally listened. And he said, here's the word of advice I have for you. When you get into that realm of people who you're going to be rather uncomfortable, nail your flag to the mast the moment you get there. Because I was a Christian. And I thought, is it that important to make sure that people knew what my commitment was from the outset? And I listened to him, and I did that. It was very uncomfortable. And I had a horrible time as people mocked me and people. But you know, I'm so glad that I did that. Because it was out of this commitment that my identity was created. It's commitment that creates identity. You never find yourself. So our direction as parents and grandparents for our kids is to help them find a decent commitment in life, because it's out of commitment that we create ourselves. No way to find yourself. Some of you are looking at me and saying, yes, I'm 80 years old. I still haven't found myself. You know, well, you better find yourself quickly, baby. Okay, the next one. Okay, the picture that we have here is just this, I, and you know when they have it in the movie, this thought pattern, who am I? Okay. Then we move to the 20s, to the 30s, and the next question in life is, what am I going to do with my life, and who am I going to do life with? Two questions at this particular stage. In the 20s to 30s, we need to make commitments to other things. Now, we talk about careers, and we talk about callings. Everybody should have both. We all have a career, but some people will forget their calling because their career becomes too important. Every one of us, as a Christian, I really believe that there's a purpose for your existence. There absolutely is. God did not put you on this planet just to breathe air, take up space, and whine and moan. He didn't do that. He created you for a real reason. That's the uniqueness of the God that we have. He's not that concerned with your career as much as he is with your calling. Now, I can say this because I can say that I look back on my years and I could sense, I didn't know what it was, but I just knew that there was more to life than just making money. There was more to life than just doing that stuff. And at the end of the day, having a little head, a nice comfortable life, I knew from young that there's got to be more to life than just that. And sometimes our careers can overwhelm that which we would call our calling. You ever look at a biblical example? Have a look for a moment at Moses. Moses was the son of Pharaoh, and that was like his career. He was destined for greatness in Egypt. That was going to be his career. But God had other ideas. And God had ideas. He says, no, that's not what I want for you. That's your career. You have a calling. You can either be the son of Pharaoh, or you can be the leader of the children of Israel. And he chose, fortunately, the leader of the children of Israel. But here's how sometimes it suddenly hits you. When you suddenly have this light bulb moment, and it generally happens at the point of a crisis in your life, when all of a sudden you wake up, and you wake up and you say, good night, my entire life I've been pouring into career, and as a result of a crisis, all of a sudden your calling becomes that much more important, and you think, wow, only just in time. For me, my career was a farmer. You know, we did quite nicely in Joburg. We bought a little farm, and then we had 3 years of drought. We lost our farm in 3 years, and I was in crisis. And in the middle of that crisis, all of a sudden I became very, very aware of my calling, and I sacrificed any other career to follow my calling. Now, that's my story, but it could be yours, and it should be each one of ours as we seek to find not just our careers, but to find our callings as well. I began to realize that life is kind of like a Monopoly game. And I don't want to knock people who are really into their careers. I don't want to knock that's fine. But, you know, life is kind of like a Monopoly game. We play this game. We wheel and deal. We trade. We lose. We gain. Everything. But at the end of the day, when the game's all over, we put it back in the box, hey? And we start the game all over again. Your life is like that. At the end of your life, all that you've done and poured your life in and wheeled and dealt, I suddenly realize it's just like a Monopoly game. There will come a day when the game will be over. We'll put all the stuff back in the box and somebody else will start all over again. I don't want to end like that. I don't want to end like that. So our careers must never overwhelm to the point where we forget that we have a calling. That's the first question. You know, what am I going to do with my life? So here we have a guy looking. The second question is, who am I going to do it with? Because you've got to find yourself a partner who you're going to do. It's the next big question. How do I choose a life partner? And some people do the stupidest of things. They choose their life partner for all the wrong reasons. Well, I happen to have married, you know, a couple over here. And there's a couple of things that I often share with young people who are just finding their careers, establishing callings, and now they want to find a life partner. We need to choose our life partner with our head, not so much our hearts, because it's a thing that is intellectually oriented. Here's how we do it. It's very simple. Let me put it to you like this. The Greeks have a great way of in their language. In English, we often have just one word for something. The Greeks don't have that in some words. For instance, the word love. We just have the word love. The Greeks, you will know this, all have three words for that. The first word that they have for love is the word eros, from which we get the word erotic. That's a romantic kind of love. You know, that's that thing where you sweat and you have, you know, and you know, that's romance. But romance is a lousy foundational wish to build a marriage. We need to have something more than romance, because romance, if you've been married for any length of time, if you're honest, declines in intensity over the course of the years, does it not? You know, now you've got to replace it with something. If you do not replace love, romance with something, then your marriage dies when romance dies. So the Greeks have another word. They have a word philos, which word we get the word philosophy, which is the love that exists between those who are friends. Friends is a graduation on romance. And friendship, when it grows out of romance, is better than romance. And I want to take nothing away from romance. We need to keep that alive as long as we can. But friendship is a higher grade in the Greek philosophy of thinking of this thing called love. And friendship exists between those who have common goals and common dreams and common ideals. This is how important it is. There was a psychologist guy who did a study on compatibility. And he did the study and he says, let's study marriages. He says, let's study marriages that people got married because they fell in love. And let's study marriages of people who got married because of computer deity. And let's do a comparison to see which marriages lasted. You know what they found? The computer dating marriages lasted longer than the romance ones, by far, based upon one thing called compatibility. Compatibility. Romance wasn't even on the scene. And compatibility is determined like this. You can determine compatibility by what we call the big one. We always have triangles. We talk about triangles, eh? The power of a triangle. They said this, that compatibility is not based upon how many things you agree on, but it's based upon what they call the big one. The big one. If you share the same big one with your marriage partner, you will be found compatible. Even if you do everything else wrong and different, if she supports the shark set and he supports the Western province and he likes pasta and she likes steak, you know, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. I just hope you never support Western province. But anyway. Compatibility is not based upon the number of things you're based upon. It's based upon the big one. But here's how it works. Visualize your life as being like this triangle, and you're told to work out what is the big one. Along the baseline of the triangle, you arrange everything that's important to you. So there's your work, there's your hobby, there's your family, there's your other stuff. Everything that is important to you is along the baseline. As you move towards the apex of the triangle, the baseline gets shorter and shorter and shorter, leaving room for fewer and fewer things. The question we ask is, when you get to the top of the triangle, there's only room for one thing. What is it? Or who is it? And if you find that you share the same thing that's at the top of your triangle with the person you want to marry, don't worry about the rest, you will find compatibility based upon the big one. So this is where the Bible talks about being unequally yoked. You know, it's talking about the big one in each one of those things. That is, you've got one who's got this, and I like work, and I like money, and you've got, you know, you could be pulled apart in no time at all. So tell your kids when they come to you, I want to get married, do the exercise with them. And here's why. Because if you have, and my recommendation, I don't know anybody bigger than God. So if you put God at the top of the triangle over here, and you've got God on the top of the triangle here, here's Mary, and here's Fred. As they journey towards God, what happens to them? They get closer and closer. But I see many marriage counseling situations where they're trying to fix the issues that are between them. If I could just fix this one, we'd be closer together. Never works. It's hard work. Oh, let's talk about this. You know, we spend hours talking about that, and we beat each other up verbally over that whole thing. That doesn't work. So my thesis is this. As you find the big one that is common to you both, as you journey, both of you, towards the big one, the two of you automatically get closer and closer together, and it's very, very simple. Is it that simple? Hey, people, I'm an old man now, and I've done a lot of this stuff. I have to tell you, it's that simple. It's that simple. We make life so complicated. If we could do this, it's not simplistic, but it certainly is quite simple. So we're going to teach our kids how to make better choices on who to marry. The next phase is, if you're married already, you're too late, so bad luck. Some of you are thinking, man, I wish I'd done this 40 years ago. Okay. Let's move to that's the 20s to 30s. Okay, let's move to 30s to 40s now. The questions begin to change. They begin to get more serious now. The question that we need to ask right now is, how do I manage all the demands and expectations of my life? Think back to your 30s and 40s, people. That was the hyperactive era. You've got kids at home. You've got a boss that's demanding. And you end up being, this is a great picture, a chicken without a head. A horse will beat that. The 30s to 40s are panic times. And you've got a boss that you've got to please, and you've got kids that you've got to support, and then you are torn between all of these things. I have kids who are in their 30s now, and they're saying, "Dad, now we understand. We used to, as kids, criticize you because, man, you just weren't always there for us. My heart was with them, but man, I've got a boss who says, you want to earn a salary, you got to work. And now I'm torn between all of these different things that are happening, and I've got a wife, and I've got a bond, and I've got bonds, and I've got kids, and I've got illnesses, and I've got snotty-nosed children running all over the place, and I'm torn apart between all of these things." This is the manic period of time. Let me tell you the greatest test of this particular time is a test of character. This is where your character begins to come through during the 30s to the 40s. I did this with Deanna at her school last night. You know, life is like an iceberg. This is where you are like an iceberg. I don't say you're cold, but anyway. An iceberg, you do know, has 80% below the waterline, 20% above. The 20% of the above is the stuff that people can see. That's the stuff that people will know about you. The 80% below the waterline is who you really are. That's your character. Nobody sees it. Nobody knows it except you and your Creator. They're the only people who go down here. Now, we can fool one another with the top 20%, and we can look a lot better than we really are. And I could fool you. You'll think, "Oh, this sucks. He's all right. No, I'm not all right. I'm messed up. Yeah, I'm a broken human being just like anybody else." And the top 20% is where we can so easily fool one another. But the problem is we spend 80% of our time working on the top 20%. If we could take the 80% of energy that we use for the top 20% to make us look good and be better, then if we could put that into below the waterline stuff, that could change us. And the reason we need to do some work down here is simply because of this. I hope I'm not going to run out of paper here. Probably am. Let's find another piece. Somebody else has drawn it. Oh, that was last night. Let me do it down here. Okay, I'm going to draw it small. Okay. You know, you live in Durban, you see these beautiful yachts floating on the sea going past you here. And there's Nigel, you know, being tough without his shirt on and his boop, and, you know. And here's Deirdre doing her thing, looking sharp. You know, and they're sailing along in the ocean when all of a sudden the wind begins to blow and the little waves that were once so nice begin to kind of get a little bit big, and then they see a huge wave coming towards them, and they begin to panic. And you often wonder, how does the little yacht out there manage to stay upright? How does that little dude stay upright in the midst of the wind and the storm and the waves and everything like that? Well, it's easy. You see, below the waterline of a yacht is a thing called a keel. And a vast percentage, up to 80% of the weight of this yacht is in the keel. So when the wind blows here and the waves hammer here, that little yacht's not sinking because he's firm because of what he's got below the waterline. That's like our character. The reason we need to do work here is because of the below the waterline stuff. So when we hit the storm, you don't need the below the waterline stuff when everything's going plain sailing. You don't need a depth of character because you could cruise at that stage. But when the tests of life come, and the storms of life roll in on you, and the waves are about to crash, you have to rely on a depth of character. If you don't have it, you're in trouble. Now, one of the things that needs to happen in order to create a depth of character is we need help with this. I'm into this whole mentoring thing. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that term. Coaching people, mentoring people, I think is vitally important. And we often look at this and we say, well, why do I need a mentor? A mentor is not your friend. Because a friend tells you what you want to hear. A mentor is somebody who tells you what you need to hear. A mentor should not be a parent necessarily. It can, and to some extent, be a parent. But a mentor is somebody who's outside of your life, who's looking into your life, is not afraid to tell you what you need or need not to do. I've got to say, these people can keep you on track. Because if you were to visualize this little yacht out in the midst of the ocean, as the guy in this is looking down to the shoreline, he can see, oh dear me, I'm in the midst of the storm, but I can see a light here. If I can head for the lighthouse, I'll probably be safe. But the problem is, as he looks towards the lighthouse, he looks along the shoreline, and he can see shipwrecks all around. He says, man, these are the shipwrecks of lives of people just like me. I don't want to end up as a statistic. How do I get into the shore and remain safe? Well, we do some deep sea fishing where I go. And what we do is when we're out at sea, we line up certain things. There's a point on land that we line with a couple of other points along the way, and we avoid all the rocks and all the stuff. If you follow the lights, follow the points, doesn't matter how big the storm is, doesn't matter how close you get to the rocks, if you've got more than 3 points lined up, you're going to land at the shore absolutely safely. Now, if that's like life, we need to find some lights. They're your mentors. They're the people who you trust enough to speak into your life. And during the age of 30s to 40s is the most prime time for us to need them. In the midst of all of the stuff that's going on and the busyness of life, everybody needs a mentor. I had one. And he was the pastor of the church across the road, Charles Gordon. Remember Charles? Loved that man. And Charles Gordon, one day he heard about me, so he phones me. And he was a big man. And when he spoke, he growled. I don't know if you remember. He used to scare the living daylights out of me. You know. But one day he phones me and says, "My name's Charles Gordon. I'm coming to see you." Phone down. He goes, "Who is this dude?" Anyway, old Charles Gordon arrives. And he walks into my office and he wanted to have a look at what we're doing and the whole Genesis thing. And then all of a sudden he took it upon himself to be a self-appointed mentor to me, old Charles. Once a month, Charles Gordon would phone me and he would say, he always called me by my surname. He would say, "Dunham, how's your heart?" That's what he said. But he didn't even no frivolous peripheral stuff. "Hey, Dunham, how's your heart?" And I'm like, "Hey, Charles, you know, no, man, the church is going good. I didn't ask about the church. I asked about your heart." You know, yes. Every month this oak would phone me, man. And I would think up stuff and I would try and build us there, but he could see straight through me. But I want to tell you, I so appreciate now what that man asked me, because he kept my heart straight, because he didn't take no for an answer. He never became my best friend. I never did Sunday lunch with Charles, but he used to phone me once a month regularly. I used to dread his calls. And then I used to begin to appreciate his calls because I knew what was happening. That as I began to share with him the challenges that people in my position had, and he was retiring from over here. He was no longer at COGS anymore. And he was a retired pastor, and he took it upon himself to mentor young pastors by asking the question, "How's your heart?" Because the heart, out of the heart comes pretty much everything else. And he stuck with that one question month after month after month. When Charles Gordon died, they invited me to come up to his funeral. And so I go to the funeral and say some stuff. Anyway, as I come over the front of the church over there, I walk into the front row and I see a whole lot of other men sitting there. So these guys say, "What are you doing here?" And they say, "You know, you're not going to believe this, but old Charles Gordon, once a month, he would phone me and he would say, 'How's your heart?' I go to the next dude, same story. Charles Gordon had become a career mentor. And he poured his life, those remaining years of his life, into us younger men, and he kept us on track during this tough period of time. Every one of us needs a person like that, especially during that period of time. Let's move on. Now we're into the 40s to 50s. Things get really interested over here. This is where we kind of go into that whole midlife deal. And the question that we're asking at this particular point is, how satisfied am I with my life? How satisfied am I with my life? And we begin to look around and we see all our contemporaries and they've got bigger cars than us and nicer houses than us and they've got more money than us. And we're still in the zone of those significant others. When you're a baby, your significant other is your mother because she feeds you. When you become a teenager, your significant other becomes your peers. You dress like them, you talk like them, you have the same haircut as them, you hang with them. You're like the same. They become your others, your significant others. When we move into the 20s to 30s, the opposite sex become our significant others, and we try and do everything we can to get their approval. When we hit the 30s to 40s, our workmates become. When we hit 40s to 50s, man, our contemporaries in work, us men, a heck of a competitive. You know, have I got more stuff than him? That guy's doing better than me. I need to work harder. You know, we begin to beat ourselves up over these things. And then we begin to find ourselves that, you know, we're in this awful competition, you know. And I had a friend who I went up fishing with some time back, and I was with another guy, and he said to this other guy, he said, so So he said to him, he said, Pete, what have you got to show for your life? And I know what he was asking. He was saying, Pete, what kind of car do you drive? How many houses do you own? How big is your business? How many people do you employ? And I began to realize that he was measuring his success by the stuff that you can touch and measure. And poor old Peter gave the greatest of answers. He said, Dave, if you want to know how much I own or what I've got in the bank, if you measure success like that, he said, Dave, you beat me. You've got more than me. You beat me. But if you measure success by the lives that people have touched, that I have touched, that I have reached out to, that's a different measure of success. So success is a very relative term because we each get to define it the way that we see it. But we need to have a more accurate perception of what success is. And that's why for the 40s to 50s here at that time, I suppose, going into midlife crisis, the greatest challenge here for those who have supposedly become successful is the challenge not so much as my career to my calling, but my comfort now to my calling. And if I could draw another picture here, I would draw the picture of a lazy boy and a remote control. I have to tell you, I see men in that age group who have done really well in business, settling for their lives for a lazy boy and a remote control. And I look at them and say, what a waste. How sad is that? But for the answer to the question of this 40s to 50 age group, how satisfied in my life, some of you will have known this little exercise to find where the answer is. If I were to say to you, here's 9 dots, and I'm going to give you 4 lines to draw that would go through each one of those dots. You've got to cover them all with 4 straight lines. You know, let me put you out of your misery. You've probably seen this before. It would look something like this, because you can't do it internally. In order for you to draw it, you've got to go like this. Here, 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 there. I didn't say the lines had to stay in the box. You see, if you're going to draw the 4 lines, you're allowed to go outside of the box. Now, here's the challenge for the 40s to 50s. Here's your opportunity to start thinking outside of the box, to find the satisfaction that you are searching for. You're not going to find it in the box anymore. And the outside of the box thing could take you to a great place. For some people, it takes themselves to a Harley Davidson, you know, or some 50-year-old is going to trade his some 50-year-old wife in for 2 25-year-olds, you know. And because they're trying to find satisfaction, they look at the stupidest of places. You know a guy's going through his midlife crisis. You do know this when he gets a fat gold chain. I'm checking to see he's got that. Or they blow dry their chest hair. Have you seen people who do that? You know you're in midlife when you do that kind of stuff, you know. You know that you're in trouble. But it can be a very dangerous period of time, midlife, because you can make some serious mistakes. There needs to be an answer to what am I going to do outside of the box that will bring me the satisfaction that I'm searching for in my 40s to 50s in our materialistic success on one side oriented lifestyle. Down where I come from, we have a hero. His name is Popeye. Love Popeye. And we often talk about Popeye where I come from. We talk about Popeye moments. And I love talking to 40s to 50s. Say, have you had a Popeye moment recently? A Popeye moment is simply this. In the cartoon, Popeye has got an enemy. His name is Brutus. And Brutus is always kidnapping olive oil and tying it to the railway track or doing something. And Popeye's always getting beaten up by Brutus until he says this. This is his main line. He says, as Popeye says, I just can't stand it no more. Have you heard that? And he pops a spinach, dom, and then boing, and then he decks Brutus and he rescues olive oil in the nick of time, and he's the hero. But the question that he asks is, what can't I stand no more? Because when you get to this stage in life, I want to ask you, what can't you stand no more? If we're settling in there for a TV and a remote control and a lazy boy, we have to ask ourselves, is there anything in my life that really angers me? That really angers me? Is there issues of injustice as you look around the world that make you angry? There should be. Are there issues of child abuse and wife abuse and these dysfunctional things? At this stage in life, we have the privilege to be able to respond to this question. What makes you angry? Because angry is better than tears. We think, oh, if I can make people cry, I can motivate them to do something for somebody else. Hey, tears come and tears go. If I can make you feel bad, I can lay guilt on you that you're not helping the people around. That's another motivator. But guilt is a lousy motivator to make people change. Anger, however, is not. When we get angry about the things that are... I get every day and I get angry, more angry by the day at the things that I see taking place in the community around me. And I know it's this anger, this righteous anger, that is able to sustain my journey to do the stuff that I'm passionate about. It's not because I necessarily cry. I do cry for them. But that doesn't motivate me anymore. It's anger at the injustices of the world. And I'm saying to you, supposedly successful, 40 and 50 year old, get out of your darn chair and throw the remote control, sell your TV, and do something outside of the box. But keep the TV when you want to watch rugby, okay? Or Nigel says you can all go to his house and watch rugby there, okay? But it's all about this midlife crisis, and I hope that my friend Popeye is going to say something to you. Let's move quickly. I'm taking too long here. Let's go to the 50s and 60s. All right. This is a development of the other one. That is a rugby ball. Okay. The question we ask in the this is now the 50s to 60s. Eh? I'm halfway dead at 50. If we get to live to 100, which is unlikely, we're halfway dead. And the question I need to ask is, I'm at halftime in my life. And the question is, you know, if you go to a rugby game and the rugby players will go into the tunnel at halftime, you're going to say, what are they doing in the tunnel? Is they're not eating tea and biscuits. They're not putting their feet up and having a Coke. You know what they're doing in the tunnel at halftime is they're planning the second half. Based upon the successes and failures of the first half of my life, let me sit now and plan the second half so I finish well. And we get to this age. You can do it at any stage in your life. But particularly in the 50s and 60s, when we're hitting halftime, we should be saying, what would I change in order to play a better second half? And based upon the successes and the failures, we get to plan this great exercise. The thing about it is, nobody remembers the halftime score. And you can finally be halfway through this thing and be ahead of the pack. But at the end of the day, nobody remembers the halftime score. 1995, does anybody remember the halftime score of the World Cup final? What was the halftime score? Nobody remembers. What was the final score? Yeah, we all remember the final score, but nobody remembers halftime. And it's that with life. We still got a second half to play, guys. And I'm passionate about this because that's the half I'm in. And I want to play a really good second half. But here's the deal. In order to move from success to significance, there's a difference. When you turn your success into significance, you're going to hate me for this, and I'm going to run afterwards. It's through sacrifice. When you take the success that you've worked so hard for and you've earned it, and you say, man, I've earned this thing, and I've done the long hours, and I've taken the risks and made the investments, I deserve my success. Well, you will die successful, and that's cute, but it's not what you really want. Nobody wants to die successful. I have buried hundreds of successful people. I could tell you stories, but I've only ever buried a handful of significant ones. And these are the people who have been willing to take their success and to sacrifice it so that they can become significant. That is a cool concept. When you take all that you've done and earned and that which you have achieved and you're willing to lay it on the altar and say, God, now I've got it. How can I use this in an endeavor to become significant through sacrifice? As I look around the room, most of us in that category right now, how do we turn our success into significance? There's only one way, and that is through sacrifice. That's why I love the church, because the church is an avenue through which you can get to do that kind of beautiful stuff. Numbers, phase 7. That's phase 7. You're sweating. How long can I keep going, holding on to the things that define me? I'm 60 years old now. How long can I keep going? How long can I hold on to these things? Physically, I'm not what I used to be. Mentally, I'm kind of drained. I'm sitting with the regrets and the jealousies that have taken their toll. I'm threatened by the next generation. I'm running on empty. How do I hold on to the identity that I created back here? And the answer is simply found in, you don't need to hold on to it. You can let it go. And that's where the significant through sacrifice comes. So, you know, back here, it's about management of your time. when you get here, I'm not managing my time anymore, I'm managing my energy. That's a far better thing. I didn't work according to the clock anymore, I work according to the energy that I have. And I manage the energy very cleverly, very carefully, because I'm not what I was when I was in my 30s to 40s. But the best way to be able to do this is crying out, how long can I hold on to this thing? The key that used to define me could now be the very thing that confines me. Let me say that again. The thing that used to define me back here could now, if I don't let it, could kill me. It could be the thing that confines me. And so we're going to continue our journey here. Now, I do need another piece of paper for this. Got to be something here. Let's get clever. Okay. All right. I need to draw you another triangle here. We all know Maslow's triangle hierarchy of needs. You know that, eh? Maslow's got this hierarchy of needs thing here. There are four of them. You know, there's safety. There's physical needs down the bottom here. I need to be physically cared for. There's emotional needs that I need here. There's wellness needs. And then he ends up with this thing of self-actualization at the top. That's Maslow's hierarchy of need. Okay. And he suggests that that's where you get to the epitome of life, where you realize self-actualization. Well, I think he's missed it. I think there's another triangle. And the reason that we need to do the sacrifice thing is very simply, you're never going to be happy until you do. The happiest people in the world are the people who have learned how to sacrifice their success in order to be significant. But here's what it looks like. Now you've got a triangle that looks like this. Okay, coming out of Maslow, I think. He ends with self-actualization. And I'm suggesting that there's another four levels that need to take place. And these take you into the realm of self-transcendence. Okay, he says self-actualization. I'm suggesting there's something above that called self-transcendence. This is the happiness triangle. Everybody wants to be happy. Here's how we do it. At the lowest level of happiness, we have this thing called immediate gratification. That means if I'm hungry and you give me a breakfast, I'm satisfied. It's the lowest level of happiness. But because I eat too much, in 2 hours' time, I need to be gratified at that level again. It keeps coming back very often. We graduate from immediate gratification to ego satisfaction. That means in this realm of happiness, level two, call that one, in level two, I'm happy when I win. I'm happy when I beat you. I'm happy when I earn more money than you. I'm happy when my team beats your team. And my ego is stoked at level two. But here's an intriguing thing. Happiness level three, see if you can understand this one, is the opposite of happiness level two. If you want to be happy at the point of ego satisfaction and in life, not many people, if we're honest, graduate beyond themselves here. It's all about me, myself, I have to win. But when you graduate to happiness level three, is the happiness that you get when you help somebody else to win. That's beautiful, hey? It's this happiness that gets me out of bed in the morning, that I get to participate in helping other people to win. I don't need to win anymore. I'm past that. But to be able to help somebody else to win gives me a higher level of personal satisfaction and happiness than even if I'm winning myself. That's a level high. And sadly, not many people in the world graduate to level three. But level four is a big one. Level four is happiness that happens as a result of a relationship with your Creator. If you don't have a relationship with God, you will never aspire to level four. I did this talk, or the happiness thing, at a school once, and I invited the kids to ask a question. And the one kid stood up and said, hey, Uncle Trevor, is it possible to be happy at level four, even if you're miserable at level one, two, and three? Absolutely it is. Just think of some of the martyrs of the old day. They loved God with everything they had, and they were in and of themselves just so absorbed and happy in the relationship they had with God that even though they were hungry, even though ego-wise they were nowhere, there was nothing they could do to get ego, even though they couldn't even help anybody because of the situation, they understood the reality of perfect happiness because of a relationship with your Creator. People, this is a big deal. You will never understand true happiness until you hit level four over here. But sadly, in the context of many people in the world, they don't even graduate level two to level three. So in the 60s to 70s, it's all about finding that. Now, in the 30s to 40s, okay, this is fun, eh? In the 30s to 40s, you needed a mentor. In the 60s to 70s, you become one. That's the beauty of what I want to talk to you about. Where you begin to give yourself to somebody other, somebody else. And it's the beauty of that relationship that really makes all of the difference. Now, where are we? 50s, 60s to 70s. Let's go 70s to 80s. Now we're in our league, okay? Now we're in our league. From the 60s to the 80s, we're in. And the question that we're asking right here is how do I cope with loss and obscurity? Sickness comes into your life. Many of us older people begin to understand. We're asking ourselves, can I still add value to the things around? It's tough to let go of the things that you've been building on and the things that have created your identity in a community or in a workplace. And your friends begin to die, and you begin to realize, hey, man, I'm in the 70s, the 80s now. I may not have that much longer to go. We don't like talking about this stuff, but I think we need to. In the 70s and 80s, the temptation for us is to become territorial. Hold on to our little territory. The temptation in our 70s that has become really grumpy, to become bitter, and to do everything we can to hold on to power. It's tough to let go. I know that. But have a look at guys like Moses. Moses had led the children of Israel for 40 years. And God says, oh, Moses, you're not going to lead them into the land. And Moses said, but Lord, I've walked all these years. I've taken them through strife and turmoil and warfare and them worshiping golden calves for 40 years. God, surely I can enter the promised land. And God said, no. You're going to pass this on to Joshua. And we see Moses graciously handing the baton to the next leader. I want to be like that, don't you? To hand the baton to the next leader and say, man, I'm going to cheer you on. I'm going to support you. I'm going to mentor you. I'm going to be there for you if you need me. That's gracious. There's nothing more beautiful than a gracious old person. Now, we need to be grateful that we've got to where we are. And now we need to, as we hand over to the next generation, we need to take the power that we once had and turn that into maybe wisdom. We need to take the success that we had and give it away. We need to cheer on the success of the next generation. We need to support new ideas. We need to love our spouses to a deeper knowledge. We need to know, be known, not for what we've been achieving, but we need to be known for our humility. Now, you only know when you think you've got humility is the moment you've lost it. So it's an indefinable kind of a thing. But I look at some of the role players that I've had in my life, and I'm just so grateful for this. But how do I cope with this loss or obscurity in my 70s and 80s? Well, there's a movie, and I don't watch many movies. But this is a movie about Rocky Balboa, okay? And Rocky Balboa, in his final movie, I think it is confronted by his son. And Rocky now looks like he's probably in his 50s. He wants to make another comeback for the 100th time. And he's confronted by his son, who's not happy that he does it. And he says, Dad, what the heck? Why you want to do this? You're going to embarrass us all. And Rocky makes one of the most Googled speeches. My kids tell me that this is one of the most Googled speeches. You know that Google thing that you people do? If you Google that thing. And it's the speech between him and his son. And he says this to his son. He says, son, there's something still in the basement. The son is saying, you're too old, Dad. He says, no, man. There's something still in the basement. And I'm in that age group. And I'm thinking, you know what? There's something still in the basement. I won't be happy until that's come out and I've done what I want to do with it. And when you search the basement between the 70s and the 80s, you will be so surprised what you find down there. How do I cope with this loss or obscurity? We invest in those closest to us, which is our family. You know, you've done the full circle. You start with the family, you end with the family. We invest in those closest to us. We have some very close friends. And on Mondays, I take their kids to swimming lessons, you see. And I love doing that. And at the swimming lesson, there was an elderly couple who bring their grandkids to the swimming lesson. And I was sitting talking to these grandparents one day, and I said, hey, guys, what do you do? And the guy smiled. He says, man, we look after our grandkids. I said, well, man, that's cool. What does that mean? He says, no, man, we pick them up for school. We pick them up and we take them home. We do their homework with them. And then we have a budget. And we have adventures with our grandkids. We take them out on adventures and we sit with them and we plan the adventures for the week. And my son, who's quite a wealthy guy, he pays me to do this. He pays me to invest in my grandchildren. And he's not investing in the world around him anymore. He's investing in those closest to him. And I'm listening with bated breath at the adventures that this man takes his kids on. They've got a budget. They work out, this afternoon we're going to go there. And this afternoon we're going to go to the game park. And we're going to do a tracking course. And we're going to do, yes. And I'm looking at this old man. He's got his two little granddaughters. They're twins. And I'm saying, man, that is so cool. I want to do that in my 70s and 80s. I want to be able... it's easy to invest in the people around you because they applaud you, you know, and we live off that applause sometimes. But I tell you, the greatest invest you could make is in your next generation. At that age group, full circle turning, take your time, take your resources, and explore the basement of your life in order to do stuff for other people as well, and take all that energy that you've still got left. Don't waste a bit of it. But never forget, guys, that we need to invest in those who are closest to us. There was a census that was taken some time back where a questionnaire was sent to hundreds of 90-year-old people. And the question was just one simple question. If you could do life again, what would you do differently? And you know what these 90-year-old people said? Here was the three most common things. The 90-year-old people were saying, the first thing I would do is I would reflect more. That's a good thing. The second thing they said, we would risk more. And the third thing, we need to learn from these old people, the third thing was they would do more in the early life that would live on after they had gone. That's what we call a legacy. You know, in Psalm 23, David finishes his psalm by saying, goodness and mercy will what? Follow me all the days of my life. But the key word there is the word surely. Why does he put surely in there? He's looking back over the first part of his life and saying, I had the quiet pastures and the green meadows and the valley of the shadow of death and the table set before me. Surely, if God has done all of that for me, then goodness and mercy is going to follow me all the days of my life. And whenever I look back, I'm going to see I've left goodness and mercy behind. That's a sign of a good life. A well-lived life. That's a sign of a great legacy. When at the end of the days, you can look behind and say, man, what's followed me all the days of my life? Goodness and mercy should follow us all the days of our life. Surely it should do that because of what God has done for us. What follows you? I see a whole bunch of people. Now, I don't want to be judgmental or critical, but certainly my observations suggest that many people look behind and they just leave trauma behind. They leave sadness. They leave brokenness behind. And it's up to us to make sure we leave a great legacy of goodness and mercy. One last thing. How do I prepare to die? How do I prepare? I'm going to draw you two pictures here, just for you love my artwork. Rest in peace. Okay. At the age of 18, this question is totally irrelevant. Like, they don't think they're going to die. Death is irrelevant. At the age of 40, the question of how am I going to die or how do I want to die or how do I prepare to die is purely academic. But when you start hitting my sort of age and up, it's the real question. This is the big one. And we got to look at this and we're going to say, well, how do we want to exit this planet? Have you got an exit strategy for getting out of here? I've got one. I've got an exit strategy. I'll tell you about it in a minute. But I'll tell you what the basics of my exit strategy is. I want to go out with a bang. That's a firework. Okay, I want to go out with a bang. I don't want to go out like a damp squib. I want to go out with a bang. Now, you've got to plan this thing. And I have an exit strategy. And it was confronted to me recently. I took a short sabbatical. And I went away and I thought about, how do I want to end? How do I want to end? Do I want to go out like my father-in-law, who had 8 years of dementia? Frightened me, a wonderful man. But the last 8 years of his life, I watched this poor man die. And I'm thinking, ish, Lord, I don't want to die like that. And then I go to a golf club. Somebody invited me to go and speak at this very fancy safari. Why they invited me, I have no idea. Anyway, I go to speak to these very successful golfers, big place, and they're all sitting, you know, very sophisticated. And they invite me to talk. And afterwards, when I'm sitting with these golfers, I'm sitting around the table, and I'm asking questions. So one question I asked about 10 guys at the table said, "So what do you guys do all day?" And they looked at me and said, "Hey, we do this. We come to the club, and we play golf." And then after we've had a go around a golf, there we'll sit and we talk. I said, "You do that every day?" "Yeah, we do that every day." I said, "That's interesting." So I said, "Well, what do you talk about?" "Oh no, we tell stories." You know, and I'm thinking, oh, every day you sit here, you have a quick round of golf, you can't wait to get into the club, you sit around and you tell stories. And surely you've told the same stories over and over and over again. And well, probably have. And every time you tell the story, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's like a war story, you know what I mean? And they acknowledged they do this every single day. Now, these are men with great resources, great experience in business, and great intellect. And I said this, probably more under my breath, I said, "Well, what a waste." And the guy said, "What? What a waste. We've earned the right to do this." I'm saying, "What a waste. With all the knowledge that you've acquired and with all the resources that you have, for goodness sake, what are you doing here? You should be investing in helping kids who are running businesses that are battling. You should be, every NGO in town would kill to have someone with your expertise on their board of directors. What the heck are you doing sitting here waiting to die, drinking drinks and playing golf and telling stupid stories?" Anyway, I began really angry. And the one guy says to the other guy, "I'm on a roll, you know, they're listening." And the other table listening too. And then one guy said to the other, he says to me, "How come nobody's ever told us this? How come nobody's ever told us this?" I said, "You're wasting your lives. You're wasting the greatest time of your life is to be able to give back and to invest into the people and around you. Don't waste a moment." Well, I don't want to die playing golf and sitting around a table. I don't want to die doing my garden either or watching TV. My brother lives in a very sophisticated retirement village up in Johannesburg, so I visit him. And early in the morning, I'm taking my walk, and there's a guy sitting, working in his garden. It's like about 5 o'clock, half past 5 in the morning. So I talk to him and introduced myself. I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "No, I'm doing my garden." I said, "Man, your garden is phenomenal. Yeah, this garden, there's not a weed in sight. Everything is manicured." And he smiles. I said, "Well, what else do you do?" "What do you mean? I do my garden. Every day. Every day. You do your garden. How old are you?" He says, 68. 68. "And you sit all day, every day, and you do your garden." He said, "No, then occasionally I'll put my feet up and I'll watch TV." And I'm thinking, do I want to die like that? Yes, I don't want to die 68 doing my garden and watching TV. You know? And we've lulled ourselves into the sense of I will die comfortably. Now, let me tell you how I want to die. I want to go to Aleppo, you know. And I'm saying, we're all going to die. You do know that, hey? We can't avoid this thing. Let's go out with a blast. Let's go out with a place where you say, I don't have long to go, you know. I don't want to die of dementia. Certainly don't want to die playing golf or doing my garden. I want to go to the most dangerous place in the world. And I want to take the gospel where nobody else wants to go. I want to go and sit in some place in the Arab country, and I want to be able to share the gospel. And if somebody cuts off my head or shoots me, it's to the plus side, because I believe in heaven. And I believe that we're going to, that's where I'm going. I don't want to leave my kids with debt. I don't want to leave my kids with, you know, I get cancer and I leave them with these enormous debts and all their inheritance is gone and keeping me alive for 6 months of pain. I want to do that. And I'm not afraid to die because I know I'm going to go to heaven. I really believe that. So if I really believe in heaven, why would I want to stay here for another 5 years of dementia? I don't want to do that. So I will take the gospel to the most dangerous place in the world that I can find. I'm registering for Red Cross right now to go into one of those Red Cross missions that goes into those. And if somebody shoots me, boom, I'm gone. Now you say, that's stupid. Now I'm not so sure it's that stupid. That's my exit strategy because I don't want to go out like a damn skirt. I'd far rather go out with a bang, wouldn't you? You're going to die anyway. For goodness sake, you've only got a few more years to go at best. So go out and take a risk at the last moments in your life. Could be the greatest adventure of your entire life. So I say that with great respect. But I think all of us need to have some. Yours will look probably different to mine. But for goodness sake, at least let's think about it. Okay, so you've got your pictures there. I've done. All right, let's just do a quick recap. Anybody want to tell me what that was? The question between 1 to 10 is, do you like me? Question between 10 to 20 is, who am I? Question between 20 to 30 is, career and who am I going to do it with? 30s to 40s. Like a chicken without a head. That's where you need a mentor. Okay. This one. Good. This one. Half time. You know, am I satisfied with the first half? Okay. This one over here. Oh, come on, people. There you go. How long can I hold on to the things that identify me? What about here? Basement. Let's get in the basement. There's still something in the basement, people. You old people, there's still something in the basement. You've got to find it and bring it out. And then lastly, go out with a bang. Okay, I've got it done. Let me just pray for us. Is that all right? Thank you. Lord, thank you for today. It's been just lovely just being here in this great church with this lovely group of people. I pray, Lord, that today as we have confronted some of the questions of life over the decades that we will live and have already lived, that, Lord, we would please you in all things, that we would live with courage, that we'd live with conviction, that our commitments would be real to the very end, so that you be glorified and your kingdom extended. There is nothing better than that to live for. There is no really any other purpose to live for other than those things. But Lord, I pray for the young people here. Lord, they've got their whole lives to live. Pray, Lord, that you would help them to find protection by finding good mentors. And they would learn what it means to take their success through sacrifice to become significant. And life goes fast so quickly. Before we know it, we look with what happened. It's gone. But what we do with that little blink of an eye determines how we will spend the rest of eternity. Lord, when we stand before you one day, and we will all stand before you, I pray that we'd have a great story to tell. In that parable Jesus told, you know, about the guys who went out and had to be stewards for him, and they wanted to stand before you and tell you the story. And those who told a good story, you said, well done, good and faithful servant. Go to heaven. Lord, I pray that we would, as we stand before you, we'd at least have a good story to tell. Bless these good people, I pray today, in Jesus' name. Amen.